My castaway this week is Johnny Vegas. As a stand-up comic, he made his name as one of the most unpredictable and brilliant acts on the circuit. His stage persona, a self-pitying drunk, belligerently heckling an audience who at times were unclear if they were watching a well-honed comedy act or witnessing a genuine breakdown. These days, with his stand-up work behind him and after a good degree of success as an actor, he describes himself as an entertainer. He's also consigned his heavy drinking to the past and lost a third of his body weight, both part of a plan to ensure he reaches the ripe old age of 40 and can be a proper father to his young son. He once said, "I always consider myself creatively at my best when at odds with the world." You once said that. I'm wondering now if you still feel that way, that it's always better to be the grit in the oyster.
I think it was certainly right for Johnny as a character. I think it does, but I'd run out of anger.
Right.
And I think people can see when something is genuine and when something's manufactured. And although I always enjoyed mixing facts with a little bit of fiction, there is a point where you go, life's actually turned around and been very good to me.
You have lost a lot of weight. How much weight have you lost?
I'm not entirely sure because I didn't weigh myself before I started, but it would have been possibly 4 stone 5. I was just judging it by trouser size. I'm an S, slightly more generous with the sizes. So
yes, I know.
Getting down to a 38 was a big whoop and holler moment for me from the changing rooms.
When I was introducing you there, I used the name Johnny Vegas. Of course, it's a stage name. Of course, you weren't born Johnny Vegas. And interesting that you referred to Johnny Vegas there in the third person. Do you feel comfortable as me introducing you with that name, or do you feel it should be your real name?
No, I'm very comfortable with it because to a lot of people, that's who I am.
Yeah, but that represents a certain thing, doesn't it? It represents that guy who sort of was on the edge, and as I say, there was that, is this for real? Is this guy absolutely losing the place here, and am I witnessing it, or is it a beautifully confected, honed stage act?
Well, I think with Johnny, what started off as something very well constructed, with absolute parameters, there was a danger point of other things in your life seeping in where the lines were blurred for the wrong reasons.
Right. So your life started to imitate your art, as it were.
Yeah. I found a popularity through self-destruction. Suddenly, the more you damage yourself, the more people are drawn to you. And that can be quite addictive.
You're trapped by your own creation, and that creation is very destructive for you as an individual.
It is when you realise that it's not a lifestyle you could maintain.
There could hardly be a more appropriate opening disc then. Tell me what it is you've chosen.
The disc I've chosen first is Johnny Cash and Hurt. I chose this because I think it's all about legacy. And again, having a son now, and I think it was Dean Martin, I think it was his family, but you see a lot of these shows where the children have had very little to do with the parents. And yet, the children are expected to laud the parents as these great entertainers who gave everything away to the public, but gave nothing back to their own family. And I didn't want that for my own son, and I didn't want that for my family and the people closest to me. They've got to know that they come first, and that I don't want to leave my son with just a pile of reviews from Edinburgh. I want to be his dad who can guide him in the same way that my father guided me.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend, everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all, my empire of dirt. I will let you down, I will make you hurt.
That was Johnny Cash and Hurt. So Johnny Vegas, you mentioned there your father and the kind of father that he's been to you when you were a little boy. Your dad was a joiner.
Yeah.
And your mum, was she at home?
Yeah, my mum stayed at home or did various cleaning jobs as and when they came along.
You famously used to do a bit in your stand-up about eating the pet rabbit. Oh, I heard it and I laughed and I obviously thought it was a joke. I learn from reading the cuttings that it wasn't a joke. What happened?
It was one of those mornings that my dad got us up for school. As we were leaving for school, he went, right, whose rabbit's going in the pot today? I genuinely thought he was joking because it was such a ridiculous concept. Came in from school and he was out in the back cleaning out the hutch, and I sort of looked around the garden and asked my dad where it was, and he went, it's there. I looked up behind me and it was skinned and hanging up. I couldn't quite believe it, so there was no tears, I didn't react. My sister went absolutely berserk, and my mum.
Did they?
Yeah. And my dad had always claimed that rabbits were livestock, but we'd never eaten one before. My dad had been laid off. That might have been not in itself a breakdown or something, but I just wonder if it was a man at the end of his tether.
How aware were you then, throughout your childhood, that money was a lack of money was a big shadow?
I was very aware. There was a definite incident one day when I was nagging my dad over an ice cream, and nagging and nagging. He took me outside to the end of the street and just said to me, I got laid off today. There'd been other children at school whose dads had been laid off, and there was that little bit of dread of, you know, kids coming back in the same school uniform, pants, yeah. Getting shorter, and the nicknames, you know, Pov and things. And then he went, so, look, here's some money, get an ice cream, but do me a favour, don't ask me for a while. The last thing I wanted then, I felt like such a little git for, you know what I mean? I just felt awful. I felt like this spoilt brat then who'd been nagging and nagging and nagging, and I should have understood and I didn't.
How old would you have been then?
I'd have been about 9.
Right.
Within a year, I'd have been heading off to seminary school. There was a lot of equipment and uniform and things that you needed to have. There was a realisation that, although they were trying to keep it from me, that was bankrupting them.
I want to talk to you much more about seminary school and all that entailed in just a second. Johnny, tell me, what's your next record then?
My next record is Deacon Blue and Dignity. Both my parents held themselves to a very difficult time, and throughout the 80s, being unemployed, and I think every day must just have been that heartbreaking thought of where's the next bit of money coming from? They just got on, but they got on with an amazing amount of dignity, and we came through it remarkably well, when it could have been, you know what I mean? It could have been a lot worse, and it must have destroyed a lot of other families.
There's a man I meet, walks up our street. He's a worker for the council, has been 20 years, and he takes no lip of nobody and litter off the gutter, puts it in the bag, and never thinks to mutter. And he packs his lunch in the Sunday's back. The children call him Boogie. He never lets on, but I know, cause he once told me, he let me know a secret about the money in his kitty. He's gonna buy a dinghy, gonna call her Dignity.
Oh, And I'll sail around the west coast, through villages and towns. I'll be on my holidays, they'll be doing the rounds. They'll ask me how I got her, I'll say, I saved my money. They say, isn't she pretty? That she called dinner. Story in a faraway sea, sipping down raki and reading Maynard Keynes. And I'm thinking about home and all that that means, and a place in the winter for dignity.
That was Deacon Blue and Dignity. So there you are, Johnny Vegas. You're the youngest of four children. Yeah. You're living in St. Helens in Lancashire, and you decide, or do you decide, or do your parents decide, that life in a seminary is the life for you? How does that come about?
It came about from my saying that I wanted to be a priest from a young age. But I think saying it because I enjoyed the reaction that it got.
What reaction did it get?
Oh, it was fantastic. The ambition of every parish is to produce its own priest. But I know for certain my mum really didn't want me to go.
How do you know that she's told you that now?
That's come out in conversations now. And I think with a lot of the negative press of late, I think it's something that my mum suspected.
Right. So she was thinking, I'm sending my little boy away to I know not what.
Yeah.
Right. And what sort of little boy were you then? I mean, did you like football? Did you play around with your brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I was pretty much the happy-go-lucky 9-year-old kid, really. Academically quite promising. I had a lovely life.
And so at 11 you go to the seminary, and what's that like? What are your memories?
It really hadn't sunk in what was happening until the first night. You're in this big, imposing school in its own grounds, you know what I mean? I suppose everybody else was just horrendously homesick. It was shell shock.
And how quickly did you realise that maybe I don't want to be a priest after all?
I think there was a series of events that made me realise I didn't want to be a priest. I didn't like the regime. It just seemed to be a place that wanted to strip you of any individuality.
And so how quickly did you come home?
I left in the fourth term. I stuck out my first year, and for me the place had very little to do with religion and a lot more to do with regime. I'd come home for Christmas and we'd gone to benediction, and we were due to drive back that evening, and I turned to my dad and told him that I didn't want to go back. And my mum was in floods of tears. And the worst thing is, at the time, I thought I'd broke her heart by leaving. And it was quite the opposite. As it turns out, it was such a relief for her.
And was there any sort of local, small-scale disgrace in the boy coming home from the seminary?
I felt like there was. I felt on me. I felt on myself that I'd let a lot of people down. Everything in my life has been about you laugh things off, you make a joke. It was very hard because there were things that went on at that school. It was very difficult to come back at weekends and people say, what you're doing is a wonderful thing. And you quietly going, it's not a wonderful thing and it's not a wonderful place.
Were you abused there?
I wasn't, no.
But you...
And it's a very difficult thing to talk about in public, because for people who are or were, it's, is it really up to me to drag that into the spotlight?
No.
And discuss that?
I suppose what I am asking is, there was a level of activity there that even as a young boy you were aware of, that other people were going through.
Yeah.
Right.
And it, I think, like I said, when I left, there was, for a long time, I felt very guilty. As I say, when I left, I almost wanted to take everybody else with me.
We're going to take a break. Let's have some music then. Tell me about what you're... We're on disc number 3 now, Johnny. What are you going to choose?
The track I've chosen now is Love Rain, Oh Me. The Who is one of them bands I could have chose any song, but this one in particular was at a point where I was somebody who was the most unsuccessful teenager with women. This was a love song that also contained all my frustrations, having been every girl's best friend, but not the bloke they actually wanted to kiss.
Only love can make it rain the way the beach is kissed by the sea. Only love can make it rain like the sweat of lovers laying in the fields. Makes you yearn to the sky. Only love can bring the rain that falls like tears from on high. Love, rain on me.
That was The Who and Love Rain Over Me. Johnny Vegas, comedian, actor, ceramicist. That seems unlikely, doesn't it?
Yeah.
How did ceramics come into your life?
Ceramics came into my life because I'd struggled to fit in. I just wanted to be the normal kid. Once I got back home, I wanted to drink cider, stand by bus stops, do everything everybody else did. I just had this thing hanging over me of, that's the priest boy. I just wanted to blend in.
Were you funny? Did you make people laugh?
I don't think I was. And there was little bits of entertainment. I'd, you know, play my nose in class and play some...
You'd play what in class, did you say?
I used to play my nose. That was my little entertainment piece.
As a musical instrument?
Yeah.
What did you play?
I played an Hawaiian tune, and I had a quiet ambition to get on That's Life.
Sounds like you should have made it.
I finished school with a few O-levels, but I think, in a way, it was very disappointing in terms of what I academically should have been able to achieve. My sister, in the meantime, pushed ahead with that, went away and studied fashion. She can't pave the way to go to college. None of us had been to college before. And when I went to sixth form, it was the first classroom, the first environment where a teacher basically said, you come in and work when you want. You couldn't get me out of that.
You said earlier that, just like a lot of teenage boys, you know, you wanted to hang around the bus shelter and drink cider. I mean, were you drinking at that point in your life, sort of in a committed way?
I was when I could get the money, yeah.
Right. And how did you manage for money at university then? Did you have enough cash?
I did. I got a full grant. My dad had warned me before I'd left to try and save some money, because what they'd experienced with Catherine was there was a lot of people there from far better off backgrounds than us. And I was quite blasé about that until I got there, and I ran up a lot of debt in my first year. But then in the second year, the party was over, there was no money, and my family couldn't afford to send me that money, and suddenly a friend in need is a pest. God forgive me, it was a very bad time when I started to resent my parents. When I first went there, I resented my parents for not being able to support me. But yeah, I graduated and then realised it wasn't the most commercially successful move I've ever made. A degree in ceramics. When have I ever gone into the Dole and they've had a card up saying Teapot Mender? I sat on the train with my dad and I made a huge mistake. Which after 4 years and putting them through all that financial pressure is not really what you want to hear from your graduate son, is it?
Let's have some music then, Johnny Figgs.
Yes, please.
What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Pulp and Common People. When I was at college, there was a lot of resentments building up that I was only really aware of when I started doing Johnny Figgs and performing. One of them was Inverted Snobbery, and it was a resentment of these people who just had everything. If you called your daddy, could stop it all, and my daddy couldn't. And this song came along and just said it perfectly. Thank you, Pulp. Thank you, Jarvis.
She came from Greece, she had a thirst for knowledge. She studied sculpture at St. Martin's College. That's where I caught her eye. She told me that her dad was loaded. I said, in that case, I'll have room and Coca-Cola. She said, fine. And then in 30 seconds time, she said, I wanna live like common people. I wanna do whatever common people do. Wanna sleep with common people. I wanna sleep with common people like you. Or what else could I do? I said, oh, I'll see what I can do. I took her to a supermarket. I don't know why, but I had to start it somewhere. So it started there. I said, pretend you got no money. And she just laughed and said, oh, you're so funny. I said, yeah. I can't see anyone else smiling. Are you sure? You wanna live like common people. You wanna see what wanna sleep with common people. You wanna sleep with common people like me. But she didn't understand. And she just smiled and held my hand.
That was Pulp and Common People. You said thank you to Jarvis Cocker there. Jarvis, of course, in that song gets the girls. You were saying at school you didn't get the girls. Did it help at university that you were one of the common people? Did it attract the ladies?
It didn't. I'd got to an age in my life of being, 22, 28, without ever having had a girlfriend. I'd actually reached a point in my life when I thought I was just going to be single, and that just wasn't meant for me. That I wasn't a relationships sort of person, that I perhaps was better off on my own. I pretty much just resigned myself to the fact that women didn't see me in the same way that I saw them.
I'm imagining when you became, even when you started to become well-known in the comedy circuit, that all changed. I mean, you know, people like somebody who's well-known and up on stage.
It did.
Did that make you cynical about what was happening, though, because you knew that there you had been, this friend of so many women, but lover of none, who suddenly was able to attract women?
It did, but I think the relief...
Quite literally.
Far outweighed. The pessimism. Again, I think what came together was I met somebody at the time that was very nice and very understanding, and so I didn't fall into the groupie lifestyle.
It was 1997 then, that was sort of your breakthrough year. That was when you were nominated for a Perrier and you were named Most Promising Newcomer. I mean, I described it as your breakthrough moment. Were you conscious of that at the time it was happening?
I think so, and I think it established me outside of the Northwest. As a festival, it was brilliant. Within 3 days, we'd pretty much sold out the run. I loved it. It was just one long, very hard party, with the gigs thrown in for good measure, you know what I mean? Everything came together and people got it. Everybody was getting it. Critics were getting it. Audiences were loving it. Perfect.
Let's have another piece of music then. Track number 5.
Track number five is Colin Hay, and it's Waiting for My Real Life to Begin. This has become a song in the past few years that, in darker moments, this is a song that you've got to believe that you're going to come through. If it's not enough for the sake of yourself, then for other people. It's given me that little bit of a push to just get off my backside and get on with it.
Any minute now, my ship is coming in. I'll keep checking the horizon, and I'll stand on the bow and feel the waves come crashing. Crashing down, down, down on me. And you say, be still, my love. Open up your heart, let the light shine in. Don't you understand? I already have a plan. I'm waiting for my real life to begin.
Colin Hay and Waiting for My Real Life to Begin. So, Johnny Vegas, you became this, to pick out a cutting, you know, the hell-raising heavyweight comic rarely seen without a pint of Guinness in his hand. That was your identity. That was the identity people paid tickets to see. That was why you got on TV. That's what people wanted from you.
They did. Whilst I was trying to craft Vegas, my usual approach was to just get as drunk as possible. And, I mean, I can count on one hand the times that I've gone on stage as Johnny, without a drink.
At its worst, how badly did the drinking affect your life? I mean, what were the points at which things were out of control?
I think there was a period in my life after college when I became so resentful, even towards friends, for there was nothing happening in my life, but I wasn't making anything happen. I'd always drunk to socialise. I'd always, you know, pubs were a culture. Everything centred around the pub. But this was drinking in a room on your own and blaming the world for you not being where you thought you should be. But then, oddly enough, the career took you back towards that path of, you know, I thought I could, maybe it was arrogant that I thought I could go out and play the Hellraiser, but then put Johnny back in his box. Mm. And I think within my personal life, I went through a separation and a divorce. And I think I was burning bridges with people because I wanted people to know I was desperately upset.
What sort of a husband were you?
I don't honestly think it lasted long enough to find out.
How long were you married for?
Less than 2 years.
Right.
I think from a relationship like that, it's not being guarded about it. I think it's one of those things that when it's very bitter, it'd be a long time before you can sit down and actually look at your own mistakes within a relationship, like within a marriage.
Are you not drinking now? Or you...
I do drink now. For me, drink has served me wonderfully. It helped me create Johnny. I see it as something that's done a lot for me, but something that can turn on you at any moment and take it all back. I enjoy a drink and I always wanted to be able to enjoy a drink, and I never wanted the drink to get to a point where you go, it's either the drink or nothing else. Do you know what I mean? That you,
yeah.
If you can't strike that happy balance between going out and that being a part of your socialising but not a part of your everyday existence.
And can you strike the balance?
I think I can. But I'm also, again, very afraid. When I was talking about my parents before, and how they came through difficult situations, I can strike that balance when things are going good. Are you a strong enough personality to be able to strike that balance under emotional duress?
And are you?
In the past, couldn't really say I've come through with flying colours.
Let's have some music then.
I am fun as well sometimes. I should point that out. I come in here incredibly earnest, you know, then you go, I like balloons.
Beautiful.
Right. Oh, sorry, yes, on it. Right, yeah, the next song, The Beautiful South and It's Domino Man. This is really a tribute to pubs and that pub culture.
Through ugly pints and Sunday breaths sit men who stare as cold as death. The wild lapels and glued up pies to made up kids and made up wives. Sitting in the heart of them is a man who's not like other men. Don't you know just who I am? And not a wink, I am the Domino Man. And if you pull a double one, I'll pack my bags and I'll be gone. And if you pull a three and four, I'm flying off to Singapore, where women dance and tigers roar. I'm lying on a distant shore. I'm living life as fast as I can. And not a wink, another drink, I am the Domino Man. Humorous through slavering jaws and angry fists, the tales of mishap and the clickety-clack is a fully paid member of the Brother of the Tap. Through heavy smoke and idle bets, through heaving lungs and heavy debts, sits a man who knows he can, and not a wink, I am the Domino Man. And if you...
That was The Beautiful South and Domino Man. You are now, Johnny Vegas, of course, a well-respected actor. The Ragged Trouser, Philanthropist, Bleak House, Happiness. Benidorm was the big ITV hit, watched by 9 million people. Did you decide to become an actor, or did people just call your agent and say, I think you might be quite good at this?
It was something I quietly wanted to do, but without having the formal training, I didn't really feel very confident about putting myself out there and saying I want to act, because I thought, if you can't do it...
Did you feel quite self-conscious to be in groups of serious, proper actors?
I always have, and it's something I've never really got to grips with.
You still do?
Yeah. I always felt like I was never fully doing justice to something that somebody else had written.
Your parents didn't come to see you do your stand-up, but I'm imagining they watch the stuff you do on TV.
Yeah, they do.
What do they think of it?
Well, they love it. I mean, it's really nice to finally do something like with Benidorm, something that my mum can discuss without bringing shame upon the family.
Is she? You say she's supportive. Is she proud?
Yeah. Yeah, very.
Because you live in St Helens. Is that where you... Are you based there? You're based at home in your hometown?
I'm based in between St Helens and Dublin at the moment.
Right.
But yes, my home is St Helens.
Right. And Dublin is for reasons of love.
My fiance lives in Dublin, so I travel between the two. My son lives in London but comes up to the northwest when we have time together.
That sounds like quite a logistically complex life, you're living there. Dublin and the northwest and London.
It is, but it's a life that makes me very happy. I'm very contented with the way life is at the moment, so I get by.
Let's have some more music then. Disc number 7.
Number 7 is It's the Lars and There She Goes. Now, for somebody who I've probably come across as so melancholy while I've been talking to you, I love love songs. I live for love, and it's such an influential presence in my life from somebody who told themselves, you know what I mean, that this probably wouldn't be for me and that relationships would just wouldn't happen. I think from being somebody who was a loner and probably got off on the notion of being a loner, I now have a lady in my life that smile makes the day. Somebody that can come along and make you realise that my life isn't best lived on my own. And with Michael, I'll love my son till the day I die. Nothing can ever change that. Whether I've struggled through my faith, through drinking, through anything, just that one guarantee has made the world a difference to my life. And I'm not a misery guts, so here we are with the Lars and There She Goes.
There she goes.
That was The Lars, a happy song, Johnny Vegas, and There She Goes. And what about the life that you've hinted at, that life of the performer? You've talked a bit about your son, Michael. And the feeling is, what, that you don't want to give up your life to performing only for him to think, well, that's my dad, but I hardly know him.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. And it can be the performance side of your life. It can be a very shallow existence. And I just couldn't forgive myself if he thought he came second, because I always did with my parents.
You're 40 this year, then.
That's
how's
just
that?
Got...
How does 40 feel?
A lot better than I actually expected. I've actually made it. That was one point in my life. I actually thought, will I reach 40? I hope it's the start of a far less traumatic chapter. I would like my 40s to just be that period of focusing on the people closest to me.
Tell me what your final record is, then.
Final record is Don McLean, Vincent. And I chose this because growing up, I tended to listen to music that was knocking about the house with my siblings. But I was very fortunate there was some quality music lying around. And Don McLean, especially now, I sit down and I'm trying to do a lot more writing now. And I both almost love and loathe him, because if I could just write one of these lines at any point in my life, you know, create anything as beautiful as a song like this, I could professionally walk away a very happy man.
Starry, starry night, paint your palette blue and grey. Look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul. Shadows on the hills, sketch the trees and the daffodils. Catch the breeze and the winter chills in colors on the snowy linen land. Now I understand what you tried to say to me, and how you suffered for your sanity, and how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they did not know how. Perhaps they'll listen now. Starry, starry night, flaming flowers that brightly blaze, swirling clouds in violet haze, reflect in Vincent's eyes of china blue, colors changing hue. Morning fields of amber grain, weathered faces lined in pain, are soothed beneath the artist's loving hand.
That was Don McLean and Vincent. So, Johnny, it comes to the point then where I'm going to give you a copy of the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. And what's your book going to be that you'll take to the island?
I will take A Ragged Charles and Philanthropist. I learn something from it every time.
Okay, well, that's
every
your
time
book.
I read it.
It's yours, and a luxury too.
A kiln.
A kiln?
A kiln. A pottery kiln.
Yeah.
Although when I finished at college, I was never financially going to feed myself or look after anybody for what I made. I really miss it. It's an incredibly therapeutic thing to do.
Let's hope it's clay-based soil, then. A kiln is yours. And if you had to choose just one of these 8 discs today, which one disc would you save?
Oh, no. It would be Johnny Cash and Hurt.
It's yours. Johnny Vegas, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you for having me.
Desert Island Discs was created by Roy Plumley, and the producer is Leanne Buckle. Kirsty Young's castaway next week is the founder of Storm Model Agency, Sarah Dukas. Desert Island Discs is available on the BBC iPlayer and is now also available as a podcast. There's more information on the Radio 4 website. Henry Ford, Biscuits, Rain and Squirrels are the subject under discussion in The Unbelievable Truth. That's after the news. But can David Mitchell's guest separate the facts from the fiction? Find out in 4 minutes' time. Then at 12:30, the food programme asks chicken or fish or something else as it examines the changing world of airline food. Now, here's Miranda Sawyer.
When I was a teenager, my early sexual feelings were expressed in the random snogathon of Spin the Bottle. Today's teens have to cope with far more advanced and specific sexual crazes, and what used to be top shelf and over 18s only is now just a mouse click away. In this programme, we'll hear teenagers speaking frankly about the stuff they'd rather us adults didn't know. That's Sex, Porn and Teenagers, here on BBC Radio 4, tomorrow night at 8.